Well, welcome to today's Talkie Bit. I was talking with a friend about the fact that we call this the Talkie Bit at the table recently, and they were just saying how much they enjoyed that label, and it gave me an opportunity to reiterate the reason why these are called Talkie Bits and not the sermon or the homily or the reflection or something else. And the reason is that it comes out of a personal value of mine, and also as a commentary on some religious history. I call these parts of our time together the Talkie Bit rather than some other name because I want to reinforce the value that says this part of our time together is not more important than some other part. It doesn't mean it's not important. It means the other parts are equally important. It means that the value of a conversation with someone when we're in a shared space, the value of sharing something online that's going on in our lives so community can be aware and participate and share the burden or share the celebration, whatever sort of illustration I might want to use of some other part of our life together as a community, what happens when the kids see one another, when they play and make things together and learn together, all of those pieces, when we sing together, they all have the potential to be equally valuable in the exploration of what we believe. And that is why we exist as a community, is to explore what we believe. I think lots of us who've grown up around the Christian religion have had occasion to be part of sort of strategic exploration, invitations to exploration, where we're invited to explore some idea or other by a community or a speaker or what have you, and the invitation is to everyone from wherever they're at, and I'm not saying it's disingenuous at all. It does leave open the question of motive, and I think there's a different flavor to exploring what we believe when the people leading the exploration are motivated by having the explorers arrive at a particular place. So the best destination for that exploration is foregone. It's already been decided. That's a very different kind of exploration than we have no idea what's around the next corner. And we're not exploring so that we can all end up in the same place. We're exploring with fully open curiosity. And we may have some shared starting places. We may have all set sail on the same boat of exploration, so to speak. But we are all moving into territory that's new and unknown without having already had somebody go before us in this supposed exploration and say, you need to end up here. It's a different space in ways that I hope are tangible, because I think that that's the space that defines the uniqueness of this community in this context. All right. On to an item in the news. As you may have noticed, unless you live under the proverbial cultural rock, you may have noticed that Queen Elizabeth died recently. And that event has raised some questions for me about the curious ways that we as humans assign value to individuals. It's been pretty typical of the proceedings following the death of the Queen for various groups, wide range of settings, to observe some moments of silence. A minute is fairly typical. We're going to observe a minute of silence. And let's say for the sake of this little mini exploration here, that minute, that actual amount of time, those 60 seconds, symbolizes some amount of value. It's like currency. I mean, that's one of the reasons we say things like time is money, right? So let's think about those seconds as being like currency, a way of making something that is invisible visible so other people can see that we share it, that we also give it value, those kinds of things. If staying silent for 1 minute could be a way of giving assent to the value of this person that lived far away from us, whose life in general had very little in common with most of ours, how many minutes of silence should we keep to show the value of the thousands of Indigenous children who died in the residential school system? We could do some rough math, and if I'm involved in it, it will be rough. But just to illustrate the continued imbalances in this story, in its 2015 report, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada documented the details of 3,201 such deaths. Current estimates suggest that that number is likely to be well over 6,000. For the purpose of the rough math I was talking about, let's say 6,000 dead Indigenous children at 1 minute per child. If this exercise seems a bit callous to you, just try to imagine what sort of logic might have justified the deaths themselves. That's, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's 100 hours. Roughly 4 days, all day and all night. And I'm not factoring in pageantry and expense, just the value of respectful, commemorative, remembering sorts of silence. I am not here to tell anyone how to observe the passing of a government figurehead or a beloved mother or mother figure or anyone else. We all have our own choices to make in those matters. But I am here to unabashedly suggest that there remains a great unrighted wrong in our midst that needs us to continue to ask, how might I remind myself and the world around me of the inestimable value of those lost children, even or maybe especially in the midst of assigning a value to the loss of a high profile, culturally speaking, a high profile individual? Personally, one of the ways I'll keep doing that in this context is by expressing my gratitude for the continued welcome that I and that we enjoy here on Treaty One, so-called because of an often abused agreement between a monarchy and the Indigenous peoples on this continent. Now, that might seem like a lot of time and energy spent on something not on topic today. Our stated topic is part two of a series on the pursuit of happiness. Wouldn't that be better served by a humorous story or maybe a full-on joke? These two gorillas walk into a bar. I don't know why that's my representative phrase for starting a joke, but it is. I have never explored that. But, you know, just something like that. Something to make the brightness of joy visible, to kind of bring the sparkle of happiness into our midst. Goodness knows the sparkle of happiness and joy is a lovely thing to be in the presence of, isn't it? Speaking of joy, some of us had the pleasure of being together in person last Sunday. Yes, we have an address again. As with other things that sometimes just happen below the waterline, I want to let the community know that the leadership team of this community has been working to resolve this for months, off and on, arguably for years. Since the pandemic started and we were in and out of lockdowns and wondering what to do about in-person versus not in-person and so on. It's been quite a journey, and I think some weariness would be appropriate, you know. But we have an address again. It does not escape my attention that the community that has responded generously to our request to share their space is the LGBTQ plus community, a community that, while continuing to find its rightful place in a diverse culture, is coming from the margins, historically speaking. And I think, whether it's conscious or otherwise, there's some overlap here. There's some resonance here with a community like The Table, which also operates on the margins of a very large thing called religion, and in some particular ways on the margins of a thing called the Christian religion. So, you know, I think that's fascinating. Again, a little hard to demonstrate. But when we did meet together in person, even with the continued complexity of what do we do with masks in this setting and our different sort of comforts and discomforts, those kind of related details, for my part at least, I can say without reservation that it felt really great to be together again, to look out over that room and see familiar faces looking back at me in the same space rather than, you know, how many people are watching, a little number on the bottom left of my screen. I mean, am I thankful for this? Yes. There's no comparing this to that in a head-to-head way in terms of the embodied lived experience as a human being. It was just, it just felt really great. I felt happy. I felt joyful. Here's the thing, though, about that feeling. I didn't have to deny sadness or grief to do it. I didn't have to squish down sadness or grief in order to feel joyful or happy in that moment. I'm very much in the midst of grieving the loss of my mom. And trailing along in the wake of that is the grief, sort of revisiting the grief of the loss of my dad. Both died in the month of August, which I expect will, for the rest of my life, have a different sort of tone to it than it did before. It was already autumnal. This kind of piles on with that a little bit. And I'm more aware, personally, in the midst of that experience, of being the next generation than I was before my mom died, which is also a complex emotional space that blends feelings like sadness and concern and determination and pride, responsibility. And that's without talking about re-engaging in public activities, broadly speaking, in the culture, while still feeling the daily echoes of pandemic fears or concerns. So that's quite a mixture, right? And I encountered an intriguing metaphor for this mixture of experiences in my study this week. This person that I was reading, writing about happiness, was trying to describe what joy is like in the midst of sorrow. And they suggested that joy is like a boat and that sorrow is like the sea. Sometimes, and we'll talk about this more as we go, sorrow seems like it's going to swamp the boat. Or at least we sure feel like that's what's going to happen, or like that's what is happening. And when we have those kinds of experiences, we might think, like, this is stupid. If I have the choice, I am just not going to set sail on the sea of sorrow at all. It is too scary. It is too dangerous. I'm going to stay right here where I am. Maybe if I turn my back on that sea, I can pretend it doesn't exist at all. Now, as tempting as that might be, in the end, it amounts to one iteration of what I was thinking of last week when I said that I wanted to explore this topic while steering clear of the toxic version of happiness. Happiness without sorrow is out of balance. It's a denial of reality. And as with other such denials, if we persist in it, there's a good chance that it'll come back and it'll bite us, and it'll bite us hard. One of my friends tells the story of sitting with his dying father and having a moment of this kind of denial. His dad was dying of cancer. The end was definitely in sight. And although his dad didn't welcome death, he seemed to be able to face it with some serenity. My friend, on the other hand, was losing it. Now, he was sobbing, he was firing off options like, maybe there are treatments available in other countries, or maybe we should be exploring alternative or complementary medical options, and he's kind of just, this stuff is just pouring out of him, and his dad just kind of gently puts up his hand and stops the runaway train, and he says to his son, go and make your peace with powerlessness. It'll go much better for you. Those words, out of context, might sound a bit stern or even uncaring. Maybe it's the go and part, I'm not sure. But I know the characters in this story, and so I can picture them sitting together, I can hear their voices, I can imagine the tone, which makes a big difference. And the tone was one of love and care. It was a father offering hard-won wisdom to a beloved son. It's not a story about fatalism. It's not a story about giving up. It's about coming to peace with our place in the world. We enjoy, in this culture, at this time, we enjoy so much agency, so much ability to say, let's do this and do it. And we enjoy that so often that it's possible to lose sight of the fact, the reality, that there are ultimately things in the face of which we do not get to have our way, so to speak. That's the stormy sea that I was talking about. Knowing that the storms are part of reality, coming to peace with our inability to stop them from happening, can give us the courage to get into the boat that is happiness. It's not about denial. In fact, it's pretty much the opposite of denial. It's a head up, eyes open acknowledgement of our true position, the clarifying of the context in which we might choose to pursue happiness. There's lots to explore there. There's more. And we'll get into that a bit more next week. But to continue our exploration today, I want to suggest some less philosophical kind of, what I've called them in my notes here is just ordinary reasons why we might want to consider setting sail in the boat of joy. Having at least generally acknowledged that our context can be a stormy one and that a happiness that denies suffering and injustice is rooted in denial, and I would argue not worth having, why might we still choose to get on board for such a journey? If the pursuit of happiness can be fairly imagined as sailing on a stormy sea, I know I just said sailing, but I should mention that often as not, we're rowing this open boat. We're not just turning on an engine and overpowering the storm from inside a sealed cabin. Given some of those parts of that metaphor, it sounds like it might be a lot of work, and I think that does reasonably raise the question, why bother? Three reasons that I find simple enough to remember and carry with me as I ponder whether I'm in for this or not. The first is, as the story that I just told you about my friend and his dad suggests, choosing to do the work of pursuing happiness, which is intertwined with making peace with what we have power over and what we don't. Choosing to do the work of pursuing happiness can make life more pleasant for us. Deliberate choice of word there with pleasant. I wanted a word that felt like it was true to the complex blend that this is. Life is hard. I'm not telling you something you don't know. It's hard on the outside with events like complicated and broken relationships. There's economic challenges. There's global pandemics. There's cars that need expensive gas and repairs. There's shingles that wear out or condo fees to take care of the shingles or like you name it, right? And it's hard on the inside too, where we face things like loneliness and that's not just circumstantial. It can be that, of course, but we can face deep loneliness even when we have friends and partners and lovers, people that are close to us. It's hard on the inside where we deal with the ways our brains don't always cooperate with our wishes or the demands that are being made on us by the prevailing norms, where the scars of abuse or trauma negatively impact our ability to navigate the world with freedom and joy, where we sometimes find ourselves baffled by ourselves. In the face of those kind of realities, it's obvious that the pursuit of happiness is going to take some hard work. What might the alternatives to doing that work be? Well, one real possibility is just accepting that life is a bummer. And there are entire schools of thought that, you know, go down this path. And I think accepting that life is a bummer should have a great big gigantic period at the end in the context of this exploration, like full stop. And the full stop is important in this consideration because this is where we encounter some of that nuance that I was touching on last week. Acknowledging that life is hard is not the same thing as resigning ourselves. Accepting the inevitability of death is not the same thing as giving up on living. In fact, doing the work of acknowledging our place in reality is precisely what can free us to do the work of pursuing happiness. It can liberate us from this undefined shadow, if you will. Maybe for those of us that like to grow things, like plants, this is a bit like doing the weeding. And as far as I can tell, pulling out the weeds does not mean that there will not be more. There will be more. And sometimes in ways that make me look at what was weeded and wonder if my memory of pulling them out was just some kind of, you know, fever dream that never actually happened. But the alternative to doing that weeding or not doing that weeding, the alternative to doing that weeding means no flowers. It means no cultivated beauty. It means no flourishing gardeners. I heard a professional gardener talking recently about how sometimes they get into a flow state or a kind of a zen space when they're weeding. I gotta say, if that's what enlightened weeding looks like, I am not there yet. I may maybe never will be. I suspect I never will be. But I can also appreciate how I'll never even move in that direction if I just look at the weeds and walk away. The point is that the pursuit of happiness is a choice that involves hard work. But it can also make life better more pleasant, more beautiful for us. I would say a second ordinary reason to pursue happiness is that our pursuit of happiness can make life more pleasant for the people around us. One way to think about this is to remember that we humans are herd animals. We need one another. And we might be able to deny that for a while under a very narrow band of hard-to-sustain circumstances, usually involving considerable wealth, privilege, and technology. But even a quick peek at the circumstances of most of humanity for most of our history as a species makes it abundantly clear that if we don't take care of one another, none of us is going to make it very far. How I live my life has an impact on how you experience and live yours, and vice versa. When I choose to cultivate a perspective on life that is positive and joyful, and I do the work of pursuing happiness while also acknowledging that it can be really tough to do that, the overflow spills into the life of others. Want to make the world a better place? Celebrate a life of joy that nourishes you and that nourishes others. It is, quite simply, one of the most generous and practical things that we can do to make life better for everyone that we come in contact with. And, in one of those curious twists of the way that love doesn't follow the rules of a limited universe, when we make a brave choice like seeking joy and then giving away what we find, our own joy will grow as a result. I don't want to overburden every sentence with caveats, as tempting as it might be, but I do want to say one thing about what I just said. I talked about seeking joy and giving away as a brave choice. What I dislike about that language, what I like about it is that it can take courage to do that. What I dislike about it is that it can suggest that those who cannot make that choice, or who find it deeply difficult to make that choice are not brave. Not the point. I would say that making a choice like seeking joy and then giving it away when we find it or encounter it could be imagined as the opposite of a vicious circle. More like a joyful spiral in the other direction, you know? All right. One more, and then we can, you know, go practice, because that's the kind of thing this is. We've touched on this a little bit already, but let me phrase it a bit differently than I have so far. I would suggest that we should choose to pursue happiness because, in some way that touches on the deepest mysteries, I think happiness tells an important truth about the world. Christian mystic Julian of Norwich wrote, "While we are in this life, we have in ourselves a marvelous mixture of both happiness and sorrow. We remain in this mixed state all the days of our lives." And then she goes on in that particular text to remind us that from her spiritual and religious perspective, we are never alone in this reality. That for, in her language, you know, God walks with us in this. And in particular, for her, that walking with us of the divine is embodied in the story of Jesus. There are things that I believe about life that I cannot prove. Some would say that that's because my faith isn't strong enough. I don't agree. I think faith is not the engine of proof. It's more like a way of bridging the gap between belief and proof. But these are things that I believe that keep me facing toward the pursuit of happiness rather than away from it or returning to that pursuit when I wander off, and I do. I'm not telling you these so that you can believe them too. I mean, if you do, it's lovely to have your company on the journey. But these are some of my core beliefs. I believe that at its core, life is rooted in goodness. You'll often hear me call that goodness by the name love. My mom called it Jesus. One of my literary mentors calls it reality. Lots of people call it some particular cultural name for God or for the divine. Its existence is impossible to prove in the lab, but the impact of choosing to believe in its existence is very provable. As a core belief, life rooted in love or goodness changes a great deal of how we experience the world. If we believe that this is what's at the root of things, then even when difficult things are happening, we find ourselves compelled to keep looking, keep looking, look deeper, look further, keep digging. Where's the root? Where in this is that core of joy? And because I believe that happiness, or joy, if you prefer that word, is good, I think these things belong together. I think goodness, love, joy, happiness, I think they belong together. And there's all sorts of stuff that gets in the way of that. But with a determined and ongoing effort, I think that we can work in the direction of aligning those values. Justin Schenkel and I were chatting about this, some of this recently, and he passed a book my way. The book is called The Happiest Man on Earth, The Beautiful Life of an Auschwitz Survivor. This is a story of Eddie Jaku. Eddie is a German Jewish man whose life was utterly upended when, as a teenager, he returned home from some studies in engineering to find his family gone from their home in Germany and the Secret Service waiting for him. An utter surprise to him. He didn't think of himself at that point in history, as he tells the story, primarily as a Jew. He thought of himself as a German. And so to come home to his country of Germany and his home there as a German person and find forces there authorized by German leadership waiting for him and his family gone, just plug German into Canadian into German if you're trying to imagine this experience. Utterly upended his life. He's beaten by these Secret Service thugs. He's arrested. He's sent to a concentration camp. And for the next 7 years, he was in those camps, first at Buchenwald and then at Auschwitz, and then finally on a forced death march in the last days of the Third Reich. Did you catch that book title? Did you catch that? The Happiest Man on Earth? The book title is not ironic. Somehow, in all of this, Eddie makes a promise to himself to smile every day in thanks for the gift of life and to honor the 6 million Jews murdered by Hitler and Hitler's regime. And it is a remarkable story of how gratitude and tolerance and kindness can serve as the on-ramps for joy, even when your context, as Eddie's was, is utter human viciousness and cruelty, and your circumstances contain no apparent reason for hope. And I want to leave us today with Eddie's words from the book's introduction. Here's what he writes in that intro. I have lived, he's 100 years old when he writes this book, I have lived for a century, and I know what it is to stare evil in the face. I have seen the very worst in mankind, the horrors of the death camps, the Nazi efforts to exterminate my life and the lives of all my people. But I now consider myself the happiest man on earth. Through all my years, I have learned this. And if you don't take away anything else from all of these words that I've said in the last half an hour, listen to this. Through all my years, I have learned this. Life can be beautiful if you make it beautiful. I will tell you my story. It is a sad one in parts, with great darkness and great sorrow. But it is a happy story in the end, because happiness is something we can choose. It is up to you. And then he ends that introduction with this sentence, I will show you how. I look forward to continuing to explore the pursuit of happiness with all of you, in the company of those who've gone before, like Eddie Jaku, and who remain convinced that this search has merit, that at the root of life is a great well of happiness that we can choose to tap, even if we feel like our boat of joy is barely staying afloat on a great sea of sadness. We'll journey together. It'll be better with company. Peace to you all. Thanks for being with me today. Thanks for being with one another today. If you're listening to this on the podcast, thanks for joining us that way. today. It is a great honor to be able to offer some thoughts into our individual and collective explorations of what we believe. Thank you for listening. Peace.